Chapter 11. Hannibal takes action. Tommy sat with the police inspector in his office. The police officer, Inspector Norris, was nodding his head gently.
I hope with any luck we may get results, Mr. Beresford, he said.
Dr. Crossfield, you say, is attending to your wife?
Yes, said Tommy. It isn't serious, I gather. It was just a grazing by a bullet, and it bled a good deal. But she's going to be all right, I think.
There's nothing really dangerous, Dr. Crossfield said.
She's not very young, though, I suppose, said Inspector Norris.
Well, she's over 70, said Tommy. We're both of us getting on, you know.
Yes, yes, quite so, said Inspector Norris.
I've heard a good deal about her locally, you know, since you came here to live. People have taken to her in a big way. We've heard about her various activities, and about yours.
Oh, dear, said Tommy.
Can't live down your record, you know, whatever it is.
Good or bad, said Inspector Norris in a kindly voice. You can't live down a record if you're a criminal, and you can't live down your record if you've been a hero either. Of one thing I can assure you, we'll do all we can to clear things up.
You can't describe whoever it was, I suppose.
No, said Tommy. When I saw him, he was running with our dog after him. I should say he was not very old. He ran easily, I mean.
Difficult age, round about 14, 15 onwards.
It was someone older than that, said Tommy.
Not had any telephone calls or letters, demands for money or anything like that, said the inspector.
Asking you to get out of your house, maybe?
No, said Tommy.
Nothing like that.
And you've been here, how long?
Tommy told him.
Not very long.
You go to London, I gather, most days of the week.
Yes, said Tommy.
If you want particulars—
No, said Inspector Norris.
No, no, I don't need any particulars. The only thing I should suggest is that, well, you don't go away too often. If you can manage to stay at home and look after Mrs. Beresford yourself—"
"Well, I thought of doing that anyway," said Tommy.
"I think this is a good excuse for my not turning up always at the various appointments I've got in London.
Well, we'll do all we can to keep an eye on things, and if we could get hold of this, whoever it is.
Do you feel, well, perhaps I oughtn't to ask this, said Tommy. Do you feel you know who it is? Do you know his name or his reasons?
Well, we know a good many things about some of the chaps round here,
more than they think we know very often.
Sometimes we don't make it apparent how much we do know, because that's the best way to get at them in the end.
You find out then who they're mixed up with, who's paying them off for some of the things they do, or whether they thought of it themselves out of their own heads.
But I think, well, I think somehow that this isn't one of our locals, as you might say.
Now, why do you think that? Asked Tommy.
Ah, well, one hears things, you know. One gets information from various headquarters elsewhere.
Tommy and the inspector looked at each other.
For about 5 minutes, neither of them spoke. They were just looking.
Well, said Tommy, I see, yes. Perhaps I see.
If I may say one thing, said Inspector Norris.
Yes, said Tommy, looking rather doubtful.
This garden of yours, you want a bit of help in it, I understand.
Our gardener was killed, as you probably know.
Yes, I know all about that. Old Isaac Bodleycott, wasn't it?
Fine old chap.
Told tall stories now and then about wonderful things he'd done in his time, but he was a well-known character and a fellow you could trust, too.
I can't imagine why he was killed or who killed him, said Tommy.
Nobody seems to have had any idea or to have found out.
Well, you mean we haven't found out?
Well, these things take a little time, you know. It doesn't come out at the time the inquest's on, and the coroner sums up and says, murder by some person unknown.
That's only the beginning sometimes.
Well, what I was going to say was, it's likely someone may come and ask you whether you'd like a chap to come and do a bit of jobbing gardening for you.
He'll come along and say that he could come 2 or 3 days a week, perhaps more.
He'll tell you, for reference, that he worked for some years for Mr. Solomon.
You'll remember that name, will you?
Mr. Solomon, said Tommy.
There seemed to be something like a twinkle for a moment in Inspector Norris's eye.
Yes, he's dead, of course, Mr. Solomon. But he did live here, and he did employ several different jobbing gardeners.
I'm not quite sure what name this chap will give you. We'll say I don't quite remember it. It may be one of several. It's likely to be Crispin, I think. Between 30 and 50 or so. Said he worked for Mr. Solomon. If anyone comes along and says he can do some jobbing gardening for you and doesn't mention Mr. Solomon, in that case I wouldn't accept him. That's just a word of warning.
I see, said Tommy. Yes, I see. At least, I hope I see the point.
Well, that's the point, said Inspector Norris. You're quick on the uptake, Mr. Beresford.
Well, I suppose you've had to be quite often in your activities.
Nothing more you want to know that we could tell you?
I don't think so, said Tommy.
I wouldn't know what to ask. We shall be making inquiries, not necessarily round here, you know. I may be in London or other parts looking round. We all help to look round.
Well, you'd know that, wouldn't you?
I want to try and keep my wife from getting herself too mixed up in things, but it's difficult.
Women are always difficult, said Inspector Norris.
Tommy repeated that remark later, as he sat by Tuppence's bedside and watched her eating grapes.
Do you really eat all the pips of grapes?
Usually, said Tuppence. It takes so much time getting them out, doesn't it? I don't think they hurt you.
Well, if they haven't hurt you by now, and you've been doing it all your life, I shouldn't think they would, said Tommy.
What did the police say?
Exactly what we thought they would say.
Do they know who it's likely to have been?
They say they don't think it's local.
Who did you see? Inspector Watson, his name is, isn't it?
No, this was Inspector Norris.
Oh, that's one I don't know. What else did he say?
He said women were always very difficult to restrain.
Really? Said Tuppence. Did he know you were coming back to tell me that?
Possibly not, said Tommy.
He got up.
I must put in a telephone call or two to London. I'm not going up for a day or two.
Well, you can go up, all right. I'm quite safe here. There's Albert looking after me and all the rest of it. Dr. Crossfield has been terribly kind, rather like a sort of broody hen watching over me.
I'll have to go out to get things for Albert.
Anything you want?
Yes, said Tuppence. You might bring me back a melon. I'm feeling very inclined to fruit. Nothing but fruit.
All right, said Tommy.
Tommy rang up a London number.
Colonel Pike away?
Yes. Ah, hello, it's you.
Thomas Beresford, is it?
Ah, you recognize my voice.
I wanted to tell you that...
Something about Tuppence, I've heard it all,
said Colonel Pikeaway.
No need to talk. Stay where you are for the next day or two or a week. Don't come up to London. Report anything that happens.
There may be some things which we ought to bring to you.
Well, hang on to them for the moment. Tell Tuppence to invent a place to hide them until then.
Oh, she's good at that sort of thing. Like our dog. He hides bones in the garden.
I hear he chased the man who shot at you both, and saw him off the place.
You seem to know all about it.
Oh, we always know things here, said Colonel Pikeaway.
Our dog managed to get a snap at him, and came back with a sample of his trousers in his mouth.
Chapter 12 Oxford, Cambridge, and Lohengrin.
Good man, said Colonel Pikeaway, puffing out smoke. Sorry to send for you so urgently, but I thought I'd better see you.
As I expect you know, said Tommy, we've been having something a little unexpected lately.
Ah, why should you think I know?
Well, because you always know everything here. Colonel Pikeaway laughed.
Quoting me to myself, aren't you? Yes, that's what I say. We know everything. That's what we're here for. But did she have a very narrow escape? Your wife I'm talking about, as you know.
Well, she didn't have a narrow escape, but there might have been something serious. I expect you know most of the details, or do you want me to tell you?
Well, you can run over it quickly if you like. There's a bit I didn't hear, said Colonel Pikeaway. The bit about Lohengrin. Grin hen low. She's sharp, you know, your wife is. She saw the point of that. It seems idiotic, but there it was.
I've brought you the results today, said Tommy. We hid them in the flour bin until I could get up to see you. I didn't like to send them by post.
No, quite right.
They were in a kind of tin box, hanging in Lohengrin. Pale blue Lohengrin. Cambridge. Victorian China outdoor garden stool.
Oh, remember them myself in the old days. Had an aunt in the country who used to have a pair.
It was very well preserved, sewn up in tarpaulin. Inside it are letters. They are somewhat perished and that, but I expect, with expert treatment.
Yes, we can manage that sort of thing all right.
Here they are, then, said Tommy. And I've got a list for you of the things that we've noted down, Tuppence and I. Things that have been mentioned or told us.
Names?
Yes, three or four. The Oxford and Cambridge clue, and the mention of Oxford and Cambridge graduates staying there. I don't think there was anything in that, because really it referred simply to the Lohengrin porcelain stools, I suppose.
Yes, 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 there are one or two other things here that are quite interesting.
After we were fired at, said Tommy, I reported it at once to the police.
Quite right.
Then I was asked to go down to the police station the next day, and I saw Inspector Norris there. I haven't come in contact with him before. I think he must be rather a new officer.
Yes, probably on a special assignment,
said Colonel Pikeaway. He puffed out more smoke. Tommy coughed. I expect you know all about him.
Oh, I know about him, said Colonel Pikeaway. We know everything here. He's all right, he's in charge of this inquiry. Local people will perhaps be able to spot who it was who's been following you about, finding out things about you. You don't think, do you, Beresford, that it would be well if you left the place for a while and brought your wife along?
I don't think I could do that, said Tommy.
Well, you mean she wouldn't come? Said Colonel Pikeaway.
Again, said Tommy, if I may mention it, you seem to know everything. I don't think you could draw Tuppence away. Mind you, she's not badly hurt. She's not ill, and she's got a feeling now that, well, that we're on to something. We don't know what it is, and we don't know what we shall find or do.
Nose around, said Colonel Pikeaway. That's all you can do in a case of this kind.
He tapped a nail on the metal box.
This little box is going to tell us something, and it's going to tell us something we've always wanted to know. Who was involved a great many years ago in setting things going and doing a lot of dirty work behind the scenes? But surely I know what you're going to say. You're going to say whoever it was is dead now. Well, that's true, but it tells us nevertheless what was going on, how it was set in motion, who helped, who inspired it, and who has inherited or carried on with something of the same business ever since. People who don't seem to amount to much, but possibly they amount to more than we've ever thought. And people who've been in touch with the same group, as one calls it. One calls anything a group nowadays, the same group, which may have different people in it now, but who have the same ideas, the same love of violence and evil, and the same people to communicate with elsewhere and other groups. Some groups are all right, but some groups are worse because they are groups. It's kind of technique, you know. We've taught it to ourselves in the last, oh, say, 50 to 100 years. Taught that if people cohere together and make a tight little mob of themselves, it's amazing what they're able to accomplish and what they're able to inspire other people to accomplish for them.
May I ask you something?
Anyone can always ask, said Colonel Pikeaway. We know everything here, but we don't always tell. I have to warn you of that.
Does the name of Solomon mean anything to you?
Ah, said Colonel Pikeaway. Mr. Solomon. And where did you get that name from?
It was mentioned by Inspector Norris.
I see. Well, if you're going by what Norris said, you're going right, I can tell you that. You won't see Solomon personally, I don't mind telling you. He's dead.
Oh, said Tommy. I see.
At least you don't quite see, said Colonel Pikeaway. We use his name sometimes. It's useful, you know, to have a name you can use. The name of a real person. A person who isn't there any longer, but although dead, is still highly regarded in the neighborhood.
It's sheer chance that you ever came to live in the Laurels at all. And we've got hopes that it may lead to a piece of luck for us. But I don't want it to be a cause of disaster to you or your missus. Suspect everyone and everything is the best way. I only trust two people there, said Tommy. One's Albert, who's worked for us for years.
Yes, I remember Albert. Red-haired boy, wasn't he?
Not a boy any longer.
Who's the other one?
My dog, Hannibal.
Yes, you may have something there. Who was it? Dr. Watts, who wrote a hymn beginning, Dogs delight to bark and bite, it is their nature too. What is he, an Alsatian?
No, he's a Manchester Terrier.
Ah, an old English black and tan. Not as big as a Doberman Pinscher, but the kind of dog who knows his stuff.
Chapter 13 Visit from Miss Mullins. Tuppence, walking along the garden path, was accosted by Albert, coming down at a quick pace from the house.
Lady waiting to see you, he said.
Lady? Oh, who is it? Miss Mullins, she says she is. Recommended by one of the ladies in the village to call on you. Oh, of course, said Tuppence. About the garden, isn't it?
Yeah. She said something about the garden.
I think you'd better bring her out here, said Tuppence.
Yes, madam, said Albert, falling into his role of experienced butler.
He went back to the house and returned a few moments later, bringing with him a tall, masculine-looking woman in tweed trousers and a fair-isle pullover.
Chilly wind this morning, she said.
Her voice was deep and slightly hoarse.
I'm Iris Mullins. Mrs. Griffin suggested I should come and see you. Wanting some help in the garden, is that it?
Good morning, said Tuppence, shaking hands. I'm very pleased to see you. Yes, we do want some help in the garden.
Only just moved in, haven't you?
Well, it feels almost like years, said Tuppence, because we've only just got all the workmen out.
Ha ha ha, yes, said Miss Mullins, giving a deep, hoarse chuckle. Know what it is to have workmen in the house? But you're quite right to come in yourself and not leave it to them. Nothing gets finished until the owner's moved in, and even then you usually have to get them back again to finish something they've forgotten about. Nice garden you've got here, but it's been let go a bit, hasn't it?
Yes, I'm afraid the last people who lived here didn't care much about how the garden looked.
People called Jones or something like that, weren't they? Didn't think I actually know them. Most of my time here, you know, I've lived on the other side, the moor side of the town. Two houses there I go to regularly, one 2 days a week and the other one day. Actually, one day isn't enough, not to keep it right. You had old Isaac working here, didn't you? Nice old boy. Sad he had to get himself done in by some of this violent guerrilla material that's always going about bashing someone. The inquest was about a week ago, wasn't it? I hear they haven't found out who did it yet. Go about in little groups, they do, and mug people. Nasty lot. Very often the younger they are, the nastier they are. Well, that's a nice magnolia you've got there. Sulangiana, isn't it? Much the best to have. People always want the more exotic kinds, but it's better to stick to old friends when it's magnolias, in my opinion.
It's really been more the vegetables that we're thinking about.
Yes, you want to build up a good working kitchen garden, don't you? There doesn't seem to have been much attention paid before. People lose their spirit and think it's better really to buy their vegetables, not try and grow them.
Oh, I'd always want to grow new potatoes and peas, said Tuppence. And I think French beans, too, because then you can have them all very young.
But that's right. You might as well add runner beans. Most gardeners are so proud of their runner beans that they like them a foot and a half in length. They think that's a fine bean, always takes a prize at the local show. But you're quite right, you know. Young vegetables are the things you really enjoy eating.
Albert appeared suddenly. A Mrs. Redcliffe on the telephone, madam, he said. Wanted to know if you could lunch tomorrow.
Tell her I'm very sorry, said Tuppence. I'm afraid we may have to go to London tomorrow morning.
Oh, wait a minute, Albert. Just wait while I write a word or two.
She pulled out a small pad from her bag, wrote a few words on it, and handed it to Albert.
Tell Mr. Beresford, she said. Tell him Miss Mullins is here, and we're in the garden. I forgot to do what he asked me to do. Give him the name and address of the person he's writing to. I've written it here.
Certainly, madam, said Albert, and disappeared.
Tuppence returned to the vegetable conversation. I expect you're very busy, she said, as you're working 3 days already.
Yes. As I said, it's rather the other side of the town. I live on the other side of the town. I've got a small cottage there.
At that moment, Tommy arrived from the house. Hannibal was with him, running round in large circles. Hannibal reached Tuppence first. He stopped still for a moment, spread out his paws, and then rushed at Miss Mullins with a fierce array of barking. She took a step or two back in some alarm.
This is our terrible dog, said Tuppence. He doesn't really bite, you know, at least very seldom. It's usually only the postman he likes to bite.
All dogs bite postmen, or try to, said Miss Mullins.
He's a very good guard dog, said Tuppence. He's a Manchester Terrier, you know, and they're good guard dogs. He protects the house in a wonderful way. He won't let anyone near it or come inside, and he looks after me very carefully. He evidently regards me as his principal charge in life.
Oh, well, of course, I suppose it's a good thing nowadays.
Oh, I know, there are so many robberies about, said Tuppence. Lots of our friends, you know, have had burglars. Some even who come in broad daylight in the most extraordinary way. They set up ladders and take window sashes out or pretend to be window cleaners, or up to all kinds of tricks. So it's a good thing to let it be known that there's a fierce dog in the house, I think.
I think perhaps you're quite right.
Oh, here is my husband, said Tuppence. This is Miss Mullins, Tommy.
Mrs. Griffin very kindly told her that we wanted someone who could possibly do some gardening for us.
Would this be too heavy work for you, perhaps, Miss Mullins?
Well, of course not, said Miss Mullins in her deep voice. Oh, I can dig with anyone. You've got to dig the right way. It's not only trenching the sweet peas, it's everything needs digging, needs manuring. The ground's got to be prepared, makes all the difference. Hannibal continued to bark.
I think, Tommy, said Tuppence, you'd really better take Hannibal back to the house. He seems to be in rather a protective mood this morning.
All right, said Tommy.
Won't you come back to the house, said Tuppence to Miss Mullins. Have something to drink. It's rather a hot morning. I think it would be a good thing, don't you? We can discuss plans together, perhaps.
Hannibal was shut into the kitchen, and Miss Mullins accepted a glass of sherry. A few suggestions were made, then Miss Mullins looked at her watch and said she must hurry back.
I have an appointment, she explained. I mustn't be late.
She bade them a somewhat hurried farewell and departed.
She seems all right, said Tuppence.
I know, said Tommy, but one can't ever be sure.
One could ask questions, said Tuppence doubtfully.
You must be tired going all round the garden. We must leave our expedition this afternoon for another day. You've been ordered to rest. Chapter 14 Garden Campaign. You understand, Albert? Said Tommy. He and Albert were together in the pantry, where Albert was washing up the tea tray he had just brought down from Tuppence's bedroom.
Yes, sir, said Albert. I understand.
You know, I think you will be getting a bit of warning from Hannibal.
Oh, he's a good dog in some ways, said Albert.
Doesn't take to everyone, of course.
No, said Tommy. That's not his job in life. Not one of those dogs who welcome in the burglars and wag their tails at the wrong person.
Hannibal knows a few things, but I have made it quite clear to you, haven't I?
Yes. I don't know what I'm to do if the missus... Well, am I to do what the missus says, or tell her what you said, or...
I think you'll have to use a certain amount of diplomacy, said Tommy.
I'm making her stay in bed today. I'm leaving her in your charge, more or less.
Albert had just opened the front door to a youngish man in a tweed suit. Albert looked up doubtfully at Tommy. The visitor stepped inside and advanced one step, a friendly smile on his face.
Mr. Beresford, I've heard you want a bit of help in your garden.
Just moved in here lately, haven't you?
I noticed coming up the drive that it was getting rather overgrown.
I did some work locally a couple of years ago for a Mr. Solomon. You may have heard of him.
Mr. Solomon? Yes, someone did mention him.
My name's Crispin. Angus Crispin. Perhaps we might take a look at what one's doing.
About time someone did something about the garden, said Mr. Crispin, as Tommy led him on a tour of the flowerbeds and the vegetable garden.
That's where they used to grow the spinach, along this kitchen garden path here. Behind it were some frames. They used to grow melons, too.
Oh, you seem to be very well aware of all this.
Well, one heard a lot, you know, of what had been everywhere in the old days. Old ladies tell you about the flower beds, and Alexander Parkinson told a lot of his pals about the foxglove leaves.
He must have been rather a remarkable boy.
Well, he had ideas, and he was very keen on crime. He made a kind of code message out in one of Stevenson's books, The Black Arrow.
Oh, rather a good one, that, isn't it? I read it myself about 5 years ago. Before that, I'd never got further than kidnapped. When I was working for...
He hesitated.
Mr. Solomon, suggested Tommy.
Yes, yes, that's the name. I heard things.
Heard things from old Isaac.
I gather, unless I've heard the wrong rumours, I gather that old Isaac must have been getting on for 100 and did some work for you here?
Yes, said Tommy. For his age, he was rather wonderful, really. He knew a lot of things he used to tell us, too, things he couldn't have remembered himself.
I know, but he liked the gossip of the old days. He's got relations here still, you know, who've listened to his tales and checked up on his stories. I expect you've heard a good many things yourself.
So far, said Tommy, everything seems to work out in lists of names. Names from the past, but names, naturally, that don't mean anything to me.
They can't.
All hearsay?
Mostly. My wife has listened to a lot of it and made some lists. I don't know whether any of them mean anything.
I've got one list myself.
It only came into my hands yesterday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, what's your list?
Census, said Tommy. You know there was a census on. I've got the date written down, so I'll give it to you. And I've made a list of the people who were entered up that day because they spent the night here. There was a big party, a dinner party.
Oh, so you know on a certain date, and perhaps quite an interesting date, who was here?
Yes, said Tommy.
It might be valuable.
It might be quite significant. You've only just moved in here, haven't you?
Yes, said Tommy, but it's possible we might just want to move out of here.
Well, don't you like it? It's a nice house, and this garden,
well, this garden could be made very beautiful indeed. You've got some fine shrubs.
Wants a bit of clearing out. Superfluous trees and bushes. Flowering shrubs that haven't flowered lately and may never flower again by the look of them.
Yes. I don't know why you'd want to go and move.
Well, the associations with the past aren't terribly pleasant here, said Tommy.
The past? Said Mr. Crispin.
How does the past tie up with the present?
Oh, one thinks it doesn't matter. It's all behind us.
But there's always somebody left, you know. I don't mean walking about, but somebody who comes alive when people tell you about her or him or it or them.
So, you really would be prepared to do a bit of jobbing gardening for you?
Yes, I would. It would interest me. It's rather a hobby of mine, gardening.
There was a Miss Mullins who came yesterday.
Mullins? Mullins? Is she a gardener?
I gather something in that line. It was a Mrs. Griffin, I think it was, who mentioned her to my wife and who sent her along to see us.
Did you fix up with her or not?
Not definitely, said Tommy. As a matter of fact, we've got a rather enthusiastic guard dog here, a Manchester Terrier.
Yes, they can be very enthusiastic at gardening. I suppose he thinks your wife is his business and he practically never lets her go anywhere alone.
He's always there.
Quite right, said Tommy.
And he's prepared to tear anyone limb from limb who lays a finger on her.
Nice dogs, very affectionate, very loyal, very self-willed, very sharp teeth.
I'd better look out for him, I suppose.
Oh, he's all right at the moment. He's up in the house.
Miss Mullins, said Crispin thoughtfully.
Yes. Yes, that's interesting.
Why is it interesting?
Oh, I think it's because, I wouldn't know her by that name, of course. Is she between 50 and 60?
Yes, very tweedy and countrified.
Yes, got some country connections, too.
Isaac could have told you something about her, I expect.
I heard she'd come back to live here. Not so very long ago, either. Things tie up, you know.
I expect you know things about this place that I don't, said Tommy.
I shouldn't think so.
Isaac could have told you a lot, though. He knew things. Old stories, as you say. But he had a memory.
And they talked it over.
Yes, in these clubs for old people, they talk things over.
Tall stories. Some of them not true, some of them based on fact.
Yes. It's all very interesting, and I suppose he knew too much.
It's a shame about Isaac, said Tommy. I'd like to get even with whoever did him in. He was a nice old boy, and he was good to us, and did as much as he could to help us here.
Come on, anyway. Let's go on looking round.
Chapter 15. Hannibal sees active service with Mr. Crispin. Albert tapped on the bedroom door, and in answer to Tuppence's come in, advanced his head round the side of it.
The ladies came the other morning, he said. Miss Mullins. She's here. Wants to speak to you for a minute or two. Suggestions about the garden, I understand. I said as you was in bed, and I wasn't sure if you was receiving.
The words you use, Albert, said Tuppence. All right, I am receiving.
I was just going to bring up your morning coffee.
Well, you can bring that up and another cup. That's all. There'll be enough for two, won't there?
Yes, madam.
Very well, then, bring it up. Put it on the table over there, and then bring Miss Mullins up.
What about Hannibal? Said Albert. Shall I take him down and shut him up in the kitchen?
Well, he doesn't like being shut up in the kitchen. No, just push him into the bathroom and shut the door of it when you've done so.
Hannibal, resenting the insult which was being put upon him, allowed with a bad grace Albert's pushing him into the bathroom and adjustment to the door. He gave several loud, fierce barks.
Shut up! Tuppence shouted to him. Shut up!
Hannibal consented to shut up, as far as barking went.
He lay down with his paws in front of him and his nose pressed to the crack under the door and uttered long, non-cooperative growls.
"Oh, Mrs. Beresford," cried Miss Mullins, "I'm afraid I'm intruding. But I really thought you'd like to look at this book I have on gardening. Suggestions for planting at this time of year. Some very rare and interesting shrubs. And they do quite well in this particular soil, although some people say they won't."
"Oh, yes, that's very kind of you. Yes, I would like a cup of coffee. Please, let me pour it out for you. It's so difficult when you're in bed."
"I wonder, perhaps,"
Miss Mullins looked at Albert, who obligingly drew up a chair.
"Will that be all right for you, miss?"
"Oh, yes, very nice indeed. Oh, dear me. Is that another bell downstairs?"
"Milk, I expect," said Albert. "Or might be the grocer. It's his morning. Excuse me, won't you?"
He went out of the room, shutting the door behind him. Hannibal gave another low growl.
"That's my dog," said Tuppence. "He's very annoyed at not being allowed to join the party, but he makes so much noise.
Do you take sugar, Mrs. Beresford?"
"One lump," said Tuppence.
Miss Mullins poured out a cup of coffee. Tuppence said, "Otherwise black." Miss Mullins put down the coffee beside Tuppence and went to pour out a cup for herself. Suddenly, she stumbled, clutched at an occasional table, and went down on her knees with an exclamation of dismay.
"Have you hurt yourself?" demanded Tuppence.
"No, no, no, but I've broken your vase. I caught my foot in something. It was so clumsy, and your beautiful vase is smashed. Dear Mrs. Beresford, what will you think of me? I assure you it was an accident."
"Well, of course it was," said Tuppence kindly. "Let me see.
Oh, well, it looks as if it could have been worse. It's broken in two, which means we shall be able to glue it together. I dare say the join will hardly show."
"Oh, I shall still feel awful about it," declared Miss Mullins. "I know you must perhaps be feeling ill, and I oughtn't to have come today, but I did so want to talk to you."
Hannibal began to bark again.
"Oh, the poor wee doggy," said Miss Mullins. "Shall I let him out?"
"Better not," said Tuppence. "He's not very reliable sometimes."
"Oh, dear, is that another bell downstairs?"
"Oh, it's all right," said Tuppence. "Albert will answer it. He can always bring up a message if necessary." It was, however, Tommy who answered the telephone.
"Hello?" he said. "Yes?"
"Oh, I see."
"Who?"
"I see, yes."
"Oh, an enemy."
"Definite enemy.
Yes, that's all right. We've taken the countermeasures all right."
"Yes.
Thank you very much."
He dropped the receiver back and looked at Mr. Crispin. "Words of warning?" said Mr. Crispin.
"Yes," said Tommy.
He continued to look at Mr. Crispin. "Difficult to know, isn't it? I mean, who's your enemy and who's your friend?"
"Sometimes, when you know, it's too late. Postern of fate. Disaster's cavern," said Tommy.
Mr. Crispin looked at him in some surprise.
"Sorry," said Tommy.
"For some reason or other, we've got into the habit of reciting poetry in this house."
"Flecker, isn't it?
Gates of Baghdad. Or is it the gates of Damascus?"
"Come up, will you?" said Tommy. "Tuppence is only resting. She's not suffering from any peculiar disease or anything. Not even a sneezing cold in the head."
"I've taken up coffee," said Albert, reappearing suddenly, "and an extra cup for Miss Mullins, what's up there now with a gardening book or something."
"I see," said Tommy.
"Yes.
Yes, it's all going very well.
Where's Hannibal?"
"Shut him in the bathroom."
"Did you latch the door very tight? Because he won't like that, you know."
"No, sir, I've done just what you said."
Tommy went upstairs. Mr. Crispin came just behind him. Tommy gave a little tap on the bedroom door and then went in. From the bathroom door, Hannibal gave one more outspoken bark of defiance, then leapt at the door from the inside. The latch gave, he shot out into the room. He gave one quick glance at Mr. Crispin, then came forward and lunged with all his might, growling furiously at Miss Mullins.
"Oh, dear," said Tuppence, "oh, dear."
"Good boy, Hannibal," said Tommy, "good boy, don't you think so?"
He turned his head to Mr. Crispin.
"Knows his enemies, doesn't he? And your enemies."
"Oh, dear," said Tuppence. "Has Hannibal bitten you?"
"A very nasty nip,"
said Miss Mullins, rising to her feet and scowling at Hannibal.
"His second one, isn't it?" said Tommy. "Chased you out of our pampas grass, didn't he?"
"He knows what's what," said Mr. Crispin, "doesn't he, Dodo, my dear?"
Long time since I've seen you, Dodo, isn't it?
Miss Mullins got up, shot a glance at Tuppence, at Tommy, and at Mr. Crispin.
Mullins, said Mr. Crispin. Sorry, I'm not up to date. Is that a married name, or are you now known as Miss Mullins?
I am Iris Mullins, as I always was.
Ah, I thought you were Dodo. You used to be Dodo to me. Well, dear, I think, nice to have seen you, but I think we'd better get you out of here quickly. Drink your coffee.
I expect that's all right.
Mrs. Beresford, I'm very pleased to meet you. If I might advise you, I shouldn't drink your coffee.
Oh, dear. Now let me take the cup away.
Miss Mullins pressed forward. In a moment, Crispin stood between her and Tuppence.
No, Dodo, dear, I wouldn't do that, he said. I'd rather have charge of it myself. The cup belongs to the house, you know, and of course it would be nice to have an analysis of exactly what's in it just now.
Possibly you brought a little dose with you, did you?
Quite easy to put a little dose into the cup as you're handing it to the invalid, or the supposed invalid.
I assure you, I did no such thing. Oh, do call your dog off.
Hannibal showed every desire to pursue her down the stairs.
He wants to see you off the premises, said Tommy.
He's rather particular about that. He likes biting people who are going out through the front door.
Ah, Albert, there you are. I thought you'd be just outside the other door. Did you see what happened by any chance?
Albert put his head round the dressing room door, across the room.
I saw all right. I watched her through the crack of the hinge. Yeah, put something in the missus's cup, she did.
Very neat, good as a conjurer. But she did it all right.
I don't know what you mean, said Miss Mullins. Oh dear, I must go. I've got an appointment. It's very important.
She shot out of the room and down the stairs. Hannibal gave one glance and went after her. Mr. Crispin showed no sign of animosity, but he too left hurriedly in pursuit.
I hope she's a good runner, said Tuppence, because if she isn't, Hannibal will catch up with her. My word, he's a good guard dog, isn't he?
Tuppence, that was Mr. Crispin, sent to us by Mr. Solomon. Came at a very good moment, didn't he? I think he's been waiting his time to see what might be going to happen. Don't break that cup, and don't pour any of that coffee away until we've got a bottle or something to put it in. It's going to be analysed, and we're going to find out what's in it. Put your best dressing gown on, Tuppence, and come down to the sitting room. We'll have some drinks there before lunch.
And now, I suppose, said Tuppence, we shall never know what any of it means, or what it's all about.
She shook her head in deep despondency. Rising from her chair, she went towards the fireplace.
Are you trying to put a log on? Said Tommy.
Let me.
You've been told not to move about much.
Oh, my arm's quite all right now, said Tuppence. Anyone would think I'd broken it or something. It was only a nasty scrape or graze.
You have more to boast about than that, said Tommy. It was definitely a bullet wound. You've been wounded in war.
War it seems to have been all right, said Tuppence.
Really?
Never mind, said Tommy. We dealt with the Mullins very well, I think.
Hannibal, said Tuppence, was a very good dog there, wasn't he?
Yes, said Tommy. He told us very definitely. He just leapt for that pampas grass. His nose told him, I suppose. He's got a wonderful nose.
I can't say my nose warned me, said Tuppence. I just thought she was rather an answer to a prayer, turning up like that. And I quite forgot we were only supposed to take someone who'd worked for Mr. Solomon. Did Mr. Crispin tell you anything more? I suppose his name isn't really Crispin.
Possibly not, said Tommy.
Did he come to do some sleuthing, too?
Too many of us here, I should say.
No, said Tommy. Not exactly a sleuth. I think he was sent for security purposes. To look after you.
To look after me, said Tuppence. And you, I should say. Where is he now?
Dealing with Miss Mullins, I expect.
Yes, well, it's extraordinary how hungry these excitements make one.
Quite peckish, as one might say.
Do you know, there's nothing I can imagine I'd like to eat more than a nice hot crab, with a sauce made of cream, with just a touch of curry powder.
You're well again, said Tommy. I'm delighted to hear you feeling like that about food.
I've never been ill, said Tuppence. I've been wounded. That's quite different.
Well, said Tommy. Anyway, you must have realized, as I did, that Hannibal let go all out and told you an enemy was close at hand in the pampas grass. You must have realized that Miss Mullins was the person who, dressed as a man, hid there and shot at you.
But then, said Tuppence. We thought that she'd have another go. I was immured with my wound in bed, and we made our arrangements. Isn't that right, Tommy?
Quite right, said Tommy, quite right. I thought probably she wouldn't leave it too long to come to the conclusion that one of her bullets had taken effect, and that you'd be laid up in bed.
So she came along full of feminine solicitude, said Tuppence.
And our arrangement was very good, I thought, said Tommy. There was Albert on permanent guard, watching every step she took, every single thing she did.
And also, said Tuppence, bringing me up on a tray a cup of coffee, and adding another cup for the visitor.
Did you see Mullins, or Dodo, as Crispin called her, put anything in your coffee cup?
No, said Tuppence. I must admit that I didn't. You see, she seemed to catch her foot in something, and she knocked over that little table with our nice vase on it. Made a great deal of apology, and my eye, of course, was on the broken vase, and whether it was too bad to mend. So I didn't see her.
Albert did, said Tommy. Saw it through the hinge, where he'd enlarged it a crack, so that he could look through.
And then it was a very good idea to put Hannibal in confinement in the bathroom, but leaving the door only half-latched, because, as we know, Hannibal is very good at opening doors. Not, of course, if they're completely latched, but if they only look latched or feel latched, he takes one great spring and comes in like a Bengal tiger.
Yes, said Tommy. That is quite a good description.
And now I suppose Mr. Crispin, or whatever his name is, has finished making his inquiries. Although how he thinks Miss Mullins can be connected with Mary Jordan, or with a dangerous figure like Jonathan Kane, who only exists in the past,
I don't think he only exists in the past. I think there may be a new edition of him. A rebirth, as you might say. There are a lot of young members. Lovers of violence. Violence at any price. The Merry Muggers Society, if there's anything called that. And the super fascists, regretting the splendid days of Hitler and his merry group.
I've just been reading Count Hannibal, said Tuppence. Stanley Weyman, one of his best books. It was among the Alexander books upstairs.
What about it?
Well, I was thinking that nowadays it's really still like that, and probably always has been. All the poor children who went off to the Children's Crusade, so full of joy and pleasure and vanity, poor little souls, thinking they'd been appointed by the Lord to deliver Jerusalem, that the seas would part in front of them, so that they could walk across as Moses did in the Bible. And now, all those pretty girls and young men who appear in courts the whole time because they've smashed down some wretched old-age pensioner or elderly person who had just got a little money or something in the bank. And there was St. Bartholomew's Massacre. You see, all those things do happen again. Even the new fascists were mentioned the other day in connection with a perfectly respectable university. Ah, well, I suppose nobody will ever really tell us anything. Do you really think that Mr. Crispin will find out something more about a hiding place that nobody's yet discovered? Cisterns. You know bank robberies? They often hid things in cisterns. Very damp place, I should have thought, to hide something. Do you think when he's finished making his inquiries, or whatever it is, he'll come back here and continue to look after me? And you, Tommy?
I don't need him to look after me, said Tommy.
Oh, that's just arrogance, said Tuppence.
I think he'll come to say goodbye, said Tommy.
Oh, yes, because he's got very nice manners, hasn't he?
He'll want to make sure that you're quite all right again.
Oh, I'm only wounded. The doctor's seen to that.
He's really very keen on gardening, said Tommy. I realize that. He really did work for a friend of his who happened to be Mr. Solomon, who has been dead for some years, but I suppose it makes a good cover, that. Because he can say he worked for him, and people will know he worked for him. So he'll appear to be quite bona fide.
Yes. I suppose one has to think of all those things, said Tuppence.
The front doorbell rang, and Hannibal dashed from the room tiger-style to kill any intruder who might be wishing to enter the sacred precincts which he guarded.
Tommy came back with an envelope.
Addressed to us both, he said. Shall I open it?
Go ahead, said Tuppence.
He opened it.
Well, he said, this raises possibilities for the future.
What is it?
It's an invitation from Mr. Robinson, to you and me, to dine with him on a date the week after next when he hopes you'll be fully recovered and yourself again, in his country house, somewhere in Sussex, I think.
Do you think he'll tell us anything then? Said Tuppence.
I think he might, said Tommy.
Shall I take my list with me? Said Tuppence. I know it by heart now.
She read rapidly.
Black Arrow, Alexander Parkinson, Oxford and Cambridge porcelain Victorian seats, Grin Henlow, KK, Matilda's stomach, Cain and Abel, True Love.
Enough, said Tommy. It sounds mad.
Well, it is mad, all of it. Think there'll be anyone else at Mr. Robinson's?
Possibly Colonel Pikeaway.
In that case, said Tuppence, I'd better take a cough lozenge with me, hadn't I? Anyway, I do want to see Mr. Robinson. I can't believe he's as fat and yellow as you say he is. Oh, but Tommy, isn't it the week after next that Deborah is bringing the children to stay with us?
No, said Tommy. It's this next weekend, as ever is.
Thank goodness. So that's all right, said Tuppence.
Chapter 16 The Birds Fly South.
Was that a car?
Tuppence came out of the front door, peering curiously along the curve of the drive, eagerly awaiting the arrival of her daughter Deborah and the three children. Albert emerged from the side door.
Well, they won't be here yet.
No, that was the grocer. You won't believe it. Eggs have gone up again.
Never vote for this government again, I won't.
I'll give the Liberals a go. Shall I come and see to the rhubarb and strawberry fool for tonight?
I've seen to that, madam. I've watched you often, and I know just how to do it.
You'll be a cordon bleu chef by the time you've finished, Albert, said Tuppence. It's Janet's favourite sweet.
Yes, and I made a treacle tart. Master Andrew loves treacle tart.
The rooms are all ready?
Yes. Mrs. Shacklebury came in good time this morning. I put the Guerlain sandalwood soap in Miss Deborah's bathroom. It's her favourite, I know.
Tuppence breathed a sigh of relief at the knowledge that all was in order for the arrival of her family. There was the sound of a motor horn, and a few minutes later the car came up the drive, with Tommy at the wheel, and a moment later the guests were decanted on the doorstep. Daughter Deborah, still a very handsome woman, nearly 40, and Andrew, 15. Janet, 11, and Rosalie, 7.
"Hello, Grandma!" shouted Andrew. "Where's Hannibal?" called Janet. "I want my tea," said Rosalie, showing a disposition to burst into tears.
Greetings were exchanged. Albert dealt with the disembarkation of all the family treasures, including a budgerigar, a bowl of goldfish, and a hamster in a hutch.
"So, this is the new home," said Deborah, embracing her mother. I like it. I like it very much. Can we go round the garden? Asked Janet.
After tea, said Tommy.
I want my tea,
reiterated Rosalie, with an expression on her face of first things first. They went into the dining room, where tea was set out, and met with general satisfaction.
What's all this I've been hearing about you, Mum?
Demanded Deborah, when they had finished tea and repaired to the open air. The children, racing round to explore the possible pleasures of the garden, in the joint company of Thomas and Hannibal, who had rushed out to take part in the rejoicings. Deborah, who always took a stern line with her mother, whom she considered in need of careful guardianship, demanded,
"What have you been doing?" "Oh, we've settled in quite comfortably by now," said Tuppence.
Deborah looked unconvinced.
"You've been doing things."
"She has, hasn't she, Dad?"
Tommy was returning with Rosalie riding him piggyback, Janet surveying the new territory, and Andrew looking around with an air of taking a full grown-up view.
"You have been doing things,"
Deborah returned to the attack.
"You've been playing at being Mrs. Blenkinsop all over again. The trouble with you is there's no holding you. N or M all over again."
"Derek heard something and wrote to me."
She nodded as she mentioned her brother's name.
"Derek? What could he know?"
demanded Tuppence.
"Derek always gets to know things," said Tommy.
"You too, Dad."
Deborah turned on her father. "You've been mixing yourself up in things too. I thought you'd come here, both of you, to retire and take life quietly and enjoy yourselves."
"Well, that was the idea," said Tommy, "but fate thought otherwise."
"Postern of fate," said Tuppence. "Disaster's cavern. Fort of fear."
"Flecker," said Andrew, with conscious erudition. He was addicted to poetry, and hoped one day to be a poet himself. He carried on with a full quotation.
"Four great gates has the city of Damascus, postern of fate, the desert gate. Pass not beneath, O caravan, or pass not singing. Have you heard that silence where the birds are dead, yet something pipeth like a bird?"
With singularly apposite cooperation,
Birds flew suddenly from the roof of the house over their heads.
"What are those birds, Granny?" asked Janet.
"Swallows flying south," said Tuppence.
"Won't they ever come back again?"
"Yes, they'll come back next summer." "And pass through the postern of fate," said Andrew, with intense satisfaction.
"This house was called Swallow's Nest once," said Tuppence.
"But you aren't going to go on living here, are you?" said Deborah. "Dad wrote and said you're looking out for another house."
"Why?" asked Janet, the Rosa Dartle of the family. "I like this one."
"I'll give you a few reasons," said Tommy, plucking a sheet of paper from his pocket and reading aloud. "Black Arrow, Alexander Parkinson, Oxford and Cambridge, Victorian China Garden Stools, Grin Hen Low, KK, Matilda's Stomach, Cain and Abel, Gallant True Love."
"Shut up, Tommy, that's my list. It's nothing to do with you," said Tuppence.
"But what does it mean?" asked Janet, continuing her quiz. "Sounds like a list of clues from a detective story," said Andrew, who in his less poetical moments was addicted to that form of literature.
"It is a list of clues. It's the reason why we're looking for another house," said Tommy.
"But I like it here," said Janet. "It's lovely."
"It's a nice house," said Rosalie. "Chocolate biscuits," she added, with memories of recently eaten tea.
"I like it," said Andrew, speaking as an autocratic Tsar of Russia might speak.
"Why don't you like it, Grandma?" asked Janet.
"Oh, I do like it," said Tuppence, with a sudden unexpected enthusiasm. "I want to live here, to go on living here."
"Postern of Fate," said Andrew. "It's an exciting name."
"It used to be called Swallow's Nest," said Tuppence. "We could call it that again."
"All those clues," said Andrew. "You could make a story out of them. Even a book."
"Too many names, too complicated," said Deborah.
"Who'd read a book like that?"
"You'd be surprised," said Tommy, "what people will read and enjoy." Tommy and Tuppence looked at each other.
"Couldn't I get some paint tomorrow?" asked Andrew.
"Or Albert could get some and help me.
We'd paint the new name on the gate. And then the swallows would know they could come back next summer," said Janet.
She looked at her mother.
"Not at all a bad idea," said Deborah.
"La Reine Leveux," said Tommy, and bowed to his daughter, who always considered that giving the royal assent in the family was her perquisite.
Chapter 17 Last Words. Dinner with Mr. Robinson.
"What a lovely meal," said Tuppence. She looked round at the assembled company. They had passed from the dining table and were now assembled in the library round the coffee table. Mr. Robinson, as yellow and even larger than Tuppence had visualized him, was smiling behind a big and beautiful George II coffee pot. Next to him was Mr. Crispin, now, it seemed, answering to the name of Horsham. Colonel Pikeaway sat next to Tommy, who had rather doubtfully offered him one of his own cigarettes. Colonel Pikeaway, with an expression of surprise, said,
"I never smoke after dinner."
Miss Culloden, whom Tuppence had found rather alarming, said,
"Indeed, Colonel Pikeaway, how very, very interesting."
She turned her head towards Tuppence.
"What a very well-behaved dog you have got, Mrs. Beresford."
Hannibal, who was lying under the table with his head resting on Tuppence's foot, looked out with his best misleading angelic expression and moved his tail gently.
"I understood he was a very fierce dog," said Mr. Robinson, casting an amused glance at Tuppence.
"You should see him in action," said Mr. Crispin, alias Horsham.
"He has party manners when he is asked out to dinner," explained Tuppence. "He loves it. Feels he's really a prestige dog going into high society."
She turned to Mr. Robinson.
"It was really very, very nice of you to send him an invitation and to have a plateful of liver ready for him. He loves liver."
"All dogs love liver," said Mr. Robinson.
"I understand," he looked at Crispin Horsham, "that if I were to pay a visit to Mr. and Mrs. Beresford at their own home, I might be torn to pieces."
"Hannibal takes his duties very seriously," said Mr. Crispin. "He's a well-bred guard dog and never forgets it."
"You understand his feelings, of course, as a security officer," said Mr. Robinson.
His eyes twinkled.
"You and your husband have done a very remarkable piece of work, Mrs. Beresford,"
said Mr. Robinson. We are indebted to you. Colonel Pikeaway tells me that you were the initiator of the affair.
It just happened, said Tuppence, embarrassed. I got, well, curious. I wanted to find out about certain things.
Yes, I gathered that. And now perhaps you feel an equally natural curiosity as to what all this has been about.
Tuppence became even more embarrassed, and her remarks became slightly incoherent.
Oh, of course, I do understand that all this is quite secret. I mean, all very hush-hush, and that we can't ask questions because you couldn't tell us things. I do understand that perfectly.
On the contrary, it is I who want to ask you a question. If you will answer it by giving me the information, I shall be enormously pleased.
Tuppence stared at him with wide-open eyes.
I can't imagine, she broke off.
You have a list, or so your husband tells me. He didn't tell me what that list was, quite rightly. That list is your secret property. But I, too, know what it is to suffer curiosity.
Again his eyes twinkled. Tuppence was suddenly aware that she liked Mr. Robinson very much. She was silent for a moment or two. Then she coughed and fumbled in her evening bag.
It's terribly silly, she said. In fact, it's rather more than silly. It's mad.
Mr. Robinson responded unexpectedly.
Mad, mad, all the whole world is mad. So Hans Sachs said, sitting under his elder tree in Die Meistersinger. My favorite opera. How right he was.
He took the sheet of foolscap she handed to him.
Read it aloud if you like, said Tuppence. I don't really mind.
Mr. Robinson glanced at it, then handed it to Crispin.
Angus, you have a clearer voice than I have.
Mr. Crispin took the sheet and read in an agreeable tenor, with good enunciation.
Black Arrow. Alexander Parkinson. Mary Jordan did not die naturally. Oxford and Cambridge, porcelain, Victorian seats. Grin Hen Low. K.K. Matilda's Stomach. Cain and Abel. True Love.
He stopped and looked at his host, who turned his head towards Tuppence.
My dear, said Mr. Robinson, let me congratulate you. You have a most unusual mind. To arrive from this list of clues at your final discoveries is really most remarkable.
Oh, Tommy was hard at it, too, said Tuppence.
Nagged into it by you, said Tommy.
Very good research he did,
said Colonel Pikeaway appreciatively.
The census date gave me a very good pointer. You are a gifted pair, said Mr. Robinson.
He looked at Tuppence again and smiled.
I am still assuming that though you have displayed no indiscreet curiosity, you really want to know what all this has been about.
Oh, exclaimed Tuppence. Are you really going to tell us something? How wonderful.
Some of it begins, as you surmised, with the Parkinsons, said Mr. Robinson. That is to say, in the distant past. My own great-grandmother was a Parkinson. Some things I learnt from her. The girl known as Mary Jordan was in our service. She had connections in the Navy. Her mother was Austrian, and so she herself spoke German fluently. As you may know, and as your husband certainly knows already, there are certain documents which will shortly be released for publication. The present trend of political thinking is that hush-hush, necessary as it is at certain times, should not be preserved indefinitely. There are things in the records that should be made known as a definite part of our country's past history. Three or four volumes are due to be published within the next couple of years, authenticated by documentary evidence. What went on in the neighborhood of Swallow's Nest, that was the name of your present house at that time, will certainly be included. There were leakages. As always, there are leakages in times of war, or preceding a probable outbreak of war. There were politicians who had prestige and who were thought of very highly. There were one or two leading journalists who had enormous influence, and used it unwisely. There were men even before the First World War who were intriguing against their own country. After that war, there were young men who graduated from universities and who were fervent believers and often active members of the Communist Party, without anyone knowing of that fact.
And even more dangerous, fascism was coming into favor with a full progressive program of eventual union with Hitler, posing as a lover of peace and thereby bringing about a quick end to the war. And so on. A continuous behind-the-scenes picture. It has happened before in history. Doubtless it will always happen. A fifth column that is both active and dangerous, run by those who believed in it, as well as those who sought financial gain, those who aimed at eventual power being placed in their hands in the future. Some of this will make interesting reading. How often has the same phrase been uttered in all good faith? Old B? A traitor? Nonsense. Last man in the world, absolutely trustworthy. The complete confidence trick, the old, old story, always on the same lines. In the commercial world, in the services, in political life, always a man with an honest face, a fellow you can't help liking and trusting. Beyond suspicion, the last man in the world, etc., etc., etc. Someone who's a natural for the job, like the man who can sell you a gold brick outside the Ritz. Your present village, Mrs. Beresford, became the headquarters of a certain group just before the First World War. It was such a nice old-world village. Nice people had always lived there, all patriotic, doing different kinds of war work. A good naval harbor. A good-looking young naval commander. Of a good family. Father had been an admiral. A good doctor practicing there, much loved by all his patients. They enjoyed confiding their troubles to him. Just in general practice, hardly anyone knew that he had a special training in chemical warfare, in poison gases. And later, before the Second World War, Mr. Kane, spelt with a K, lived in a pretty thatched cottage by the harbor and had a particular political creed. Not fascist, oh no, just peace before everything, to save the world. A creed rapidly gaining a following on the continent and in numerous other countries abroad. None of that is what you really want to know, Mrs. Beresford, but you've got to realize the background first, a very carefully contrived one. That's where Mary Jordan was sent to find out, if she could, just what was going on. She was born before my time. I admired the work she had done for us when I heard the story of it, and I would have liked to have known her. She obviously had character and personality. Mary was her own Christian name, though she was always known as Molly. She did good work. It was a tragedy. She should die so young. Tuppence had been looking up to the wall at a picture which for some reason looked familiar. It was a mere sketch of a boy's head.
Is that? Surely,
yes, said Mr. Robinson. That's the boy Alexander Parkinson. He was only 11 then. He was a grandson of a great aunt of mine. That's how Molly went to the Parkinsons in the role of a nursery governess. It seemed a good, safe observation post. One wouldn't ever have thought. He broke off. What would come of it?
It wasn't one of the Parkinsons, asked Tuppence.
Oh, no, my dear. I understand that the Parkinsons were not involved in any way. But there were others, guests and friends, staying in the house that night. It was your Thomas who found out that the evening in question was the date of a census return. The names of everyone sleeping under that roof had to be entered as well as the usual occupants. One of those names linked up in a significant manner. The daughter of the local doctor about whom I have just told you came down to visit her father, as she often did, and asked the Parkinsons to put her up that night, as she had brought two friends with her. Those friends were all right. But later, her father was found to be heavily involved in all that was going on in that part of the world. She herself, it seemed, had helped the Parkinsons in garden work some weeks earlier, and was responsible for foxgloves and spinach being planted in close proximity. It was she who had taken the mixture of leaves to the kitchen on the fatal day. The illness of all the participants of the meal passed off as one of those unfortunate mistakes that sometimes happen. The doctor explained he had known such a thing happened before. His evidence at the inquest resulted in a verdict of misadventure. The fact that a cocktail glass had been swept off a table and smashed by accident that same night
attracted no attention. Perhaps, Mrs. Beresford, you would be interested to know that history might have repeated itself. You were shot at from a clump of pampas grass, and later the lady calling herself Miss Mullins tried to add poison to your coffee cup. I understand she is actually a granddaughter or a great-niece of the original criminal doctor, and before the Second World War she was a disciple of Jonathan Cain. That's how Crispin knew of her, of course, and your dog definitely disapproved of her and took prompt action. Indeed, we now know that it was she who coshed old Isaac. We now have to consider an even more sinister character. The genial, kindly doctor was idolized by everyone in the place, but it seems most probable on the evidence that it was the doctor who was responsible for Mary Jordan's death, though at the time no one would have believed it. He had wide scientific interests and expert knowledge of poisons and did pioneering work in bacteriology. It has taken 60 years before the facts have become known. Only Alexander Parkinson, a schoolboy at the time, began having ideas. "Mary Jordan did not die naturally," quoted Tuppence softly. "It must have been one of us." She asked, "Was it the doctor who found out what Mary was doing?"
"No. The doctor had not suspected, but somebody had. Up till then, she had been completely successful. The naval commander had worked with her as planned. The information she passed to him was genuine, and he didn't realize that it was mainly stuff that didn't matter, though it had been made to sound important. So-called naval plans and secrets which he passed to her, she duly delivered on her days off in London, obeying instructions as to when and where. Queen Mary's garden in Regent's Park was one, I believe, and the Peter Pan statue in Kensington Gardens was another. We learned a good deal from these meetings and the minor officials in certain embassies concerned. But that's all in the past, Mrs. Beresford. Long, long in the past." Colonel Pikeaway coughed and suddenly took over.
"But history repeats itself, Mrs. Beresford. Everyone learns that sooner or later. A nucleus recently reformed in Hollow Key. People who knew about it set things up again. Perhaps that's why Miss Mullins returned. Certain hiding places were used again. Secret meetings took place. Once more, money became significant. Where it came from, where it went to. Mr. Robinson here was called in. And then our old friend Beresford came along and started giving me some very interesting information. It fitted in with what we'd already suspected. Background scenery being set up in anticipation. A future being prepared to be controlled and run by one particular political figure in this country. A man with a certain reputation, and making more converts and followers every day. The confidence trick, in action once again. Man of great integrity, lover of peace, not fascism, oh no, just something that looks like fascism. Peace for all, and financial rewards to those who cooperate."
"Do you mean it's still going on?" Tuppence's eyes opened wide.
"Well, we know more or less all we want and need to know now. And that's partly because of what you two have contributed. The operation of a surgical nature on a rocking horse was particularly informative."
"Matilda," exclaimed Tuppence, "I am glad. I can hardly believe it. Matilda's stomach."
"Wonderful things, horses," said Colonel Pikeaway. "Never know what they will do or won't do. Ever since the wooden horse of Troy."
"Even true love helped, I hope," said Tuppence. "But I mean, if it's all going on still, with children about."
"It isn't," said Mr. Crispin. "You don't need to worry. That area of England is purified. The wasp's nest cleared up. It's suitable for private living again. We've reason to believe they've shifted operations to the neighborhood of Bury St. Edmunds, and we'll be keeping an eye on you, so you needn't worry at all."
Tuppence gave a great sigh of relief. "Thank you for telling me. You see, my daughter Deborah comes to stay from time to time and brings her three children."
"You needn't worry," said Mr. Robinson. "By the way, after the N&M business, didn't you adopt the child that figured in the case? The one that had the nursery rhyme books? Goosey Gander and all the rest of it?"
"Betty," said Tuppence. "Yes, she's done very well at university, and she's gone off now to Africa to do research on how people live, that sort of thing. A lot of young people are very keen on that. She's a darling and very happy. Mr. Robinson cleared his throat and rose to his feet. I want to propose a toast to Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Beresford in acknowledgement of the service they have rendered to their country. It was drunk enthusiastically. And if I may, I will propose a further toast, said Mr. Robinson, to Hannibal.
There, Hannibal, said Tuppence, stroking his head. You've had your health drunk, almost as good as being knighted or having a medal.
I was reading Stanley Weyman's Count Hannibal only the other day.
Read it as a boy, I remember, said Mr. Robinson. Who touches my brother touches Tavan, if I've got it right. Pike away. Don't you think? Hannibal, may I be permitted to tap you on the shoulder?
Hannibal took a step towards him and received a tap on the shoulder and gently wagged his tail.
I hereby create you a count of this realm.
Count Hannibal? Isn't that lovely? Said Tuppence.
What a proud dog you ought to be.
We hope you have enjoyed Postern of Fate by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser. Postern of Fate, text copyright 1973, Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright 1973, HarperCollins Publishers Limited. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.